Hearing this, well done. You found a way to connect to the internet. Welcome to the QAA Podcast Premium Episode 265, The Hunt for the Richest Anon. As always, we are your hosts, Jake Rakitansky,
Liv Akar,
and Travis View. Cryptocurrency, the preferred payment method of St. Petersburg ransomware developers who are holding your grandma's family photos hostage. Crypto's most devoted advocates have a near-religious belief that it, or Bitcoin specifically, is at least as revolutionary a technology as the internet itself and solves issues related to government-issued money, and will inevitably lead to a nerd-ruled anarcho-libertarian utopia on Mars, or something like that. To skeptics, Bitcoin's stratospheric increase in value since its creation 15 years ago doesn't negate fatal flaws that make it impractical as currency. These include its wild volatility, lack of tangible backing, negative environmental impact, regulatory uncertainty, and technological barriers that make it too slow for small, everyday transactions. God willing, I will be dead before we find out who's right. But until I die, I and the rest of the world are going to have to reckon with a digital asset that has a roughly $1.3 trillion market cap, is owned by tens of millions of people, and since 2021 is an official legal tender in the country of El Salvador. Part of that reckoning has to involve uncovering the identity of Bitcoin's inventor and largest holder, the anonymous Satoshi Nakamoto. While there have been plenty of online flame wars and investigations related to uncovering who authored the Bitcoin white paper, there is no consensus on the answer. But an intriguing possibility is offered in the new HBO documentary Money Electric, The Bitcoin Mystery. In it, filmmaker Colin Hoback, who also directed HBO's Cue Into the Storm, travels the globe to interview the central figures in Bitcoin's development and makes an original and controversial case for who is responsible for the blockchain-based money. Spoiler, the film points to the Canadian Bitcoin core developer Peter Todd. Peter Todd, in the film itself and in statements after the film's release, denies that he is Satoshi. And here to talk about it is Colin Hoback himself. Colin, pleasure speaking with you yet again.
I can't believe it's been three years since
3 years,
the Storm came out.
Wow. What? Yeah. No way.
I know. Yeah.
A lifetime has happened since then.
Yeah.
And also did this investigation, you know? I guess this film also happened since then.
Yeah, how long would you say that you were working on this? Were you working on it kind of while Into the Storm was finishing up, or did you start it, you know, shortly afterwards?
In the immediate aftermath of Q Into the Storm, I really wanted to take a break. But Adam McKay, who is an EP on that, he's like, you know what you should do next after finding this other anonymous guy online? I'm like, don't say Satoshi. He's like, Satoshi. Man, it's one of those stories that like a lot of people have tried. And if we were going to do it, we needed to breathe new life into it. And it's also one of those stories where if it turns out that Satoshi is no longer with us, it just won't make for as compelling of a case. So I just kind of put it on a shelf for a few months. I put together a short list of, okay, possible suspects, picked up where the researchers left off. Didn't necessarily say this is going to be the next project, more just development.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like we were joking about before the recording started, I got that call set up with Adam Back. Adam Back is this cryptographer, first person Satoshi ever reached out to. Also happens to be the guy who's behind the company that's driving that global adoption effort, which Travis just mentioned, El Salvador. Adam Back, his company was largely behind that. So to me, that was enough to say, all right, there might be more going on here. And what if Satoshi didn't actually disappear a decade plus ago? What if they're still involved? So that got me to pick up a camera again and then filmed for the next few years and did a lot of research.
Yeah. I was going to say, because, yeah, this has been kind of a white whale for online investigators. I mean, there are lots of, like, you know, well-funded newsrooms from, like, you know, The New Yorker and, like, Vice, New York Times, Wired, have all tried to answer this question. And the answers they came up with have either been too full of holes in order to be widely adopted, or they're debunked entirely. So, I mean, it certainly takes a lot of bravery to see the, you know, the number of investigations that have tried to answer this and have not been successful, and to dive in anyway.
Sure. It's a high risk endeavor. And even if you get it right, which I think we are very close to the answer in this film, you can expect that the community will, and the power players in that community, would do whatever is necessary to protect that secret. So you've got a, you know, $1.3 trillion at stake here. The idea that there could be someone who controls 1/20th of the total supply when you're trying to get countries to put this into their treasuries, when you're trying to get, you know, adoption in the traditional financial system, it might impede that growth. So there's a real incentive at the same time to protect that secret.
Yeah. You know, something I really appreciate the film is that in the very, very, first few minutes, you get into like why this matters, why this question is relevant. And not just beyond the fact that it seems like we just ought to know what created, you know, a $1 trillion asset, but also it affects the value of the asset, because it's certainly relevant to know whether or not Satoshi's Bitcoin are accessible or not, or whether or not they can be moved. I hadn't considered that before. I mean, it's like, aren't people who like invest in Bitcoin want to know and know exactly how volatile their asset is? I mean, because like whether or not those Bitcoin can be moved is going to affect, you know, its value, right?
Sure. I mean, there's also an incentive to kind of ignore the Satoshi question because of that. Mm. In some respects, it's not that dissimilar from people who believed in Q and the mechanics at play to sort of want to know, but not want to know at the same time. Like if you were to ask someone who believed in Q, who is Q? They would all have their pet theories. While at the same time say, okay, we need to protect that secret. It works very similar in the Bitcoin space. I think everybody has their pet theories. They all kind of want to know. While at the same time, knowing would actually affect the asset itself. In the same way that knowing who's behind Q would affect the asset in that case, which was the entire belief system, or could have possibly had that effect. So with Bitcoin, yeah, there's this just giant thing hanging out in the open, looming over this investment. And yeah, if Satoshi still had access to all those coins, it could potentially be a real detriment to their investment. So there is an incentive not to want to look and want to pretend like that doesn't exist.
On a similar note, one of my favorite parts of the doc is, and I'm paraphrasing, but you pose this question. It's like, you have this option before you, right? You can either be the richest, you know, one of the richest, most powerful people in the world, but by coming out, you sort of undermine this thing that you invented. And that felt to me also very similar to QAnon, where you've created this insane movement that has changed so many people's lives, that has shaped the course of politics, you know, in a major way, but by revealing who the authors are, it undermines, like, there's a similar theme here that I thought was really, really interesting.
Yeah, the mythology of this anonymous figure was part of the marketing for Bitcoin for a long time. You know, it drew people in. Oh, it was created by, you know, this anonymous person. No one knows who they are. It allowed believers, people who really wanted to push Bitcoin forward, to kind of transpose whatever identity they wanted on to Satoshi, believe that he could be some super famous cryptographer. It kind of results in this biblical story. I mean, the Genesis block, it's the first block that contains Bitcoin transactions. You know, it gave it this almost godlike Promethean quality to it. So if it turned out that Bitcoin wasn't created by some superhero, but was created by someone who was like still in college. Would that be as powerful of an origin story? And is the mythology more powerful? So I think this is, I think over time, the need and reason for anonymity kind of shifts. You know, in the beginning, the reason someone might want anonymity, and this is the case we make in the film, it's similar to what I believe Ron was doing with Q. You want people to believe that you might be Donald Trump or might be General Flynn and not some, you know, kid shit posting in his bathroom in Japan. And I think we make the same, a very similar case here where, you know, the guy we point to, Peter Todd, he would have been 23 at the time, back in 2008. And if you want people to take your idea seriously, if you want people to believe that you might be some super famous cryptographer, you would use anonymity. You might even say, oh, my name's Satoshi Nakamoto, because they could think, oh, this guy is a cryptographer from Japan. Hard to Google search that. So in the beginning, the anonymity may not have been because they knew Bitcoin was going to be this big hit. There was, in fact, no reason to believe that in the beginning. Bitcoin had a hard time bootstrapping. Satoshi had a hard time finding people to believe in his idea. But over time, that value that comes with anonymity shifts. And the reason that the community might protect that secret shifts. You know, as Bitcoin gains value, and in the beginning, you might be worried, oh, three-letter agencies could come after me. You know, it put whatever pressure. Then the anonymity protects you, perhaps, from governments. Now, I think it's shifted where people in the community would protect the secret because revealing that secret could affect Bitcoin's price. So the motives have shifted over time.
But, you know, you also talk about, like, in the film, how Bitcoin emerged from the cypherpunk community. And they treat, you know, privacy and anonymity as an intrinsic good. So, you know, wouldn't they, you know, simply be motivated to be anonymous and keep things secret, you know, for its own sake, rather than, you know, any kind of, like, you know, long-term planning kind of idea?
Sure, privacy is a kind of core ethos. It's one of the things that interested me the most about Bitcoin in the beginning, that it was trying to be digital cash for the internet. It was trying to protect our privacy, trying to make it so you could still transact anonymously without like a government knowing everything that you're buying. Mm-hmm. Of course, what Bitcoin became is something very different. And although there have been technical solutions that have been made to try to bring this digital cash aspect back to Bitcoin, it really looks more like digital gold. It looks like this new asset class that isn't, I mean, Bitcoin in itself, the way it's built, does not protect your privacy. And that's why these technological solutions that have emerged, they try to restore some of that, but it didn't really work that way. And when we talk about like, okay, like why might they protect the privacy of Satoshi? I think you're right. In the beginning, that is a really strong reason. And if Satoshi was 23 when they created Bitcoin, they have their whole life ahead of them. But that person will change over time. Their psychology will change and the motivations to protect them will shift. And also protecting the privacy of someone who may be the richest person in the world in the future. I don't know. There's a real public interest in knowing who's behind that, if they still have access. So to me, it's really not a story about privacy anymore.
I think, you know, one of your great talents as an investigator and filmmaker is the ability to, like, gain the trust of people who might be otherwise wary of journalists. So I was really wowed by this in, like, Cue into the Storm. I was like, wow, you weren't only able to embed with, like, Jim and Ron Watkins, you're able to get these extended interviews with Paul Ferber and, like, the Patriots Soapbox crew, like, those people who were, like, previously really shunned and even, like, you know, very hostile to mainstream media. And I was kind of even more impressed by, you know, you're able to do the same thing with the early developers of Bitcoin. Because like I said, these are people who have this deep philosophical belief in the importance of this privacy enhancing technology. And you got not all of them, but some of them on camera, including Amir Taki and also like Peter Todd, who, like you said, you make the case is the person behind Satoshi. So like how were able to like, you know, embed yourself and, you know, travel these people and like sometimes, you know, engage with them on their unusual hobbies, you know?
Well, I found that I had a lot of ideological overlap with the OG cypherpunks. Mm-hmm. I'd made Terms and Conditions May Apply. I'd spent almost a decade talking about digital privacy and sort of the erosion of that. So I could really relate with them on, you know, the problems that they were trying to solve in the 90s and early 2000s. And I found that, yeah, accessing kind of that core group of older cypherpunks wasn't that difficult because we saw eye to eye on a lot of things. But there is this kind of new class of Bitcoiner that emerged that has a different set of values and a different set of motives. And because those two ecosystems overlap, kind of like once you get to know one group, you get to know the other, you know. And I'm genuinely curious to see how the global adoption story was moving forward. So there was plenty to relate with these guys on. But when it comes to someone like Peter Todd, you know, this isn't a person who was on my radar. He does speak at conferences. He's been trying to drive technological solutions for Bitcoin from way back when. But he wasn't a suspect for Satoshi. Adam Back was. A lot of people had considered him to be a very likely candidate for Satoshi. He'd done all sorts of suspicious things. So when Adam Back, maybe a year into production, I think, introduces me to Peter Todd, I paid attention because, well, Adam didn't introduce me to very many people. And if he does introduce me to someone, it's probably pretty important. Mm. So I just kind of gauged their dynamic. I found it very strange that Peter seemed eager to kind of paint Adam as being Satoshi, bringing up clues, at which point in time I was like, all right, let's just shoot a scene with these guys. I don't know who this Peter guy is, but let's just put them on camera. And that was the first scene you see with Peter. Well, actually, we see him in the cave first, but that dynamic with Adam and Peter in front of that weird giant monkey right. in the scene, that's the first scene I'd shot with those two guys. And it just felt like they had a secret that I couldn't quite pin down. I thought maybe Peter knew what was going on with Adam. Maybe Adam had let him in on it. I couldn't tell. It just seemed important. So what would happen is, I mean, it wasn't easy to get these guys to continually go on camera. They're very high net worth individuals. I don't know how much they're worth, but they're also used to doing short and sweet interviews. You know, they get do an hour interview here and there, and they talk about the tech. They're not used to these prolonged relationships or prolonged investigations. So I would just put myself in the same place at the same time and then try to track them down and then coordinate these scenes. It was really the only way to do it. I couldn't just send them a message and be like, hey, you know, when we're in Riga, can we go out to some cave and go spelunking? Wouldn't work like that. I'd have to find them on site and be like, hey guys, what do you think about doing this? So it was, when you see that end scene, that was a bit of a producing miracle, getting those two guys to go out to some Soviet ruins so I could confront them on the evidence.
Well, I will say, and this is just my personal opinion as a viewer, you know, the moment that you get Adam Back on camera, he seems cagey, you know, he seems cagey, like right off the bat. And as the movie progresses, he gets more and more cagey. And like, I don't know, this doesn't mean anything. This is just like me as a human being reading another human being's body language. But I got the sense that as you dug deeper and deeper, and it sounds like, you know, maybe that's a part of the fact that these guys aren't used to prolonged sort of exposure or interviews or investigations, like you said, but it seemed like he got more and more uncomfortable, and that nervous smile that he has gets bigger and bigger as you get towards the end of the story.
I mean, Adam is a very, yeah, his eyes are kind of darting back and forth.
Yeah, shady guys. That's all I could think. I was like, these guys are so fucking shady.
You can tell he's hiding something, right? It's so apparent. But you're like, okay, well, if he's not covering for himself, who's he covering for?
Yeah.
Who would he go out of his way to kind of lie to protect? And yeah, when you get to that end scene, I mean, he just... His expression is actually, to me, in some ways more revealing than even what Peter is doing.
I thought that as well. That was my takeaway as well, that the way he reacted to the things that Peter was saying, to me, in some ways, was like, and I'm a visual person, like, you know, I pride myself on being pretty good at being able to read people, and he seemed so uncomfortable, and Peter got mad. That's what it looked like to me in that final scene, is that Peter got very defensive and Adam got very quiet and smiley. And yeah, very interesting. I am with you 100% that these two have something between them. Whether it is, you know, what the documentary sort of accuses them of, like, I don't think we can know for sure, but there is, I totally can see what you're saying, that there's some kind of secret that they've got together.
Yeah, you see Peter turning, looking back to Adam in that scene, looking kind of like he's like, help me out here. What are we going to do? what are we going to do now that Cullen's confronting us with this case?
Mm-hmm.
Say something, Adam. And Adam is just biting his lip with this kind of knowing expression. He's not going to give away the bank, but he's going to let Peter mm-hmm. manage it on his own terms.
Nowhere to go. Soviet ruins. There's nowhere to go. They're trapped with you. They're trapped with you.
Yeah.
You've got the camera in like the classic Cullen style. I know because you filmed us before where you're thinking and you're talking, but you've also got that camera in your hand and you're like, oh, fuck. Like it is. You have this amazing ability of being like strangely like conversational. Like I almost categorically hate it when filmmakers put themselves as like a character within, you know, within their doc. But there's something about you, man, that like you can get away with that. And it actually adds to it, I think, in a way that if you didn't do that, it wouldn't be as strong of a movie. Because part of the cool thing is like you sort of said earlier, you share a lot ideologically with some of the beliefs behind the principles of the foundations of Bitcoin or why something like Bitcoin is an interesting sort of concept. And so, yeah, there is this kind of like friendship that I don't know, maybe kind of like, I don't want to say tricks people, but they kind of forget that there's a story like trying to be told. And they kind of, I don't know. You get people to like sort of open up in a way that I think it makes the movie really interesting to watch.
Well, thanks for saying that. I mean, I do really try to minimize my visual footprint in these films and kind of keep myself at the sort of the lightest touch that I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a fun challenge also running the cameras while also throwing questions at people and trying to get to the bottom of this. And it's just, it's a style that's developed over time. And maybe that's what contributes to people letting their guards down. But it could also be just the amount of time I spend with them. You know, if you spend 5 hours out in some Soviet ruins, eventually, when I kind of pose the theory, maybe you don't see it coming. I don't know. But it to me, his reaction in that scene is really what it's about. It's not about what he's saying. It's not about sort of the denial. You know, he could have answered my questions. He could have just said, okay, actually, here's why back in 2010, I made the post. I gave him every opportunity to just explain what was happening, what was going on behind the scenes there. Instead, he gets defensive. He laughs in that kind of way that, you know, when your mom catches you in a lie and you're like trying to hold back laughter. To me, that's what it feels a bit like. And we don't show it in the film, but after that, you know, after the confrontation, he starts lashing out at me and like challenging my knowledge on Bitcoin. I give him some satisfactory answers. But I'd never seen Peter really at a loss for words before. Mm-hmm. And that was a unique moment to see him respond in that way. Obviously, there's so much more evidence than I was able to include in the film. It's a feature that wasn't just about this mystery. So I did confront him on a lot of that evidence that day. The reason I was doing this was really because I wanted to know if the theory was valid or not. I wanted to see if he could provide meaningful explanations for what was really going on behind the scenes there. How do you just emerge December 2010, write two posts, and on your second post, you correct Satoshi on a highly technical detail, then both you and Satoshi disappear within days, and then that highly technical thing that he corrects Satoshi on, he comes back years later and writes the code to create the thing that Satoshi was envisioning, and comes up with this whole LARP to do so. So it's really, I mean, it's about so much more than just this idea that maybe he, you know, didn't realize that he, you know, the case we make in the film is that maybe he had created this new account, logs out, didn't realize he logged back in and writes as Peter instead of Satoshi in the correction post. There's other explanations for it. I was hoping maybe he could tell me why he didn't delete it, why he made the post, what he was doing behind the scenes, how he knew as much as he did. He didn't provide any of that. And whenever he's kind of pressed on the question of why he coded this thing that Satoshi was speculated on, he usually avoids the fact that Satoshi had speculated on that. So he did eventually go on X, I guess I have to call it that now, but he did eventually go on X and try to downplay it after the confrontation. I find that his reaction, what was happening there, incredibly suspicious. And it shows a very close involvement. And I think the reaction shows they're covering something up.
It's very poetic how much of like a similar fuck up that would be to like something that Ron does. with QAnon. I'm just accidentally posting on main instead of with your anonymous account.
It's a great point. I mean, Yeah, totally. I mean, you can't escape your old forum posts, right? And you make enough forum posts, you're eventually going to make a mistake. And I think a lot of those mistakes, like with Q, happen, they tend to happen earlier on. And it's like these guys can't avoid baking themselves into the narrative. It's like the Clark Kent Superman thing. It's like, okay, I'm going to report on myself. People are going to suspect me less if I'm interacting with my alter ego in some way, if I'm commenting on my alter ego. It seems like it's part of the psychology.
It's part of the fun too, right? You know, if you're somebody who's primarily, you know, you are in your own way a Neo, right? Where you have this kind of day job or day life, right? And with, in Peter's case, you know, he was a fine arts student, but at night you're this cryptographer and you're doing all this stuff. I think that that's part of the fun, is inventing ways to throw people off the trail, which is kind of narcissistic in a way, right? That eventually you think that you're so big and so important, in this case maybe you are, that you're gonna need a breadcrumb trail that throws people off the case when it blows up in the future. I don't know, part it's part of the fun. It's the stuff that the people who are in the know, like, I have no doubt in my mind that the people who authored QAnon, the posts, laugh about it with each other in private, and how cool is that? Because you need to get that out somewhere. It's a very human thing. When you do something that has impacted a ton of people, it is very, very, very difficult to not want to talk about it with somebody, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, imagine if you had that secret. So first off, I think Ron, I would phrase it like he wanted to cuck the world. He enjoyed cucking the world. When it comes to Peter, he's got to be the smartest guy in the room, always. And you start to wonder, okay, where does that kind of chip on his shoulder come from? But I suspect that he also derives some satisfaction from fooling the whole world, from seeming smarter than anyone in the world, and being able to kind of pull one over. At the same time, though, you want to be recognized for that. And that, I've tried to imagine the psychology, you know, what it would feel like to have one of these massive global movements, to change the world so radically with this alter ego, but not really be able to talk about it. How would you get involved? It speaks to motive, and it speaks to, I think, Ron's motive, and I think it speaks to Peter's motive. It's why you see them as persistently involved in both narratives all the way to the end. They can't let it go. And there's this need to shape it. And also, I think there's a need to hand it off. Like, at some point, they want to be able to take the credit in a way. And you see a kind of handoff, I think, from Q to Ron near the tail end, or at least an attempt at it. And I think in this story, you see a kind of handoff from Satoshi to Peter. That could also be, I mean, it is part of what he was doing with that correction post. Eventually, he'll lean into it for credibility. But how does Peter kind of rise to notoriety so quickly? How is he pulling the strings kind of behind the scenes with Blockstream? Why is he such an authority so early on? How does that happen?
The Canadian spellings.
The Canadian spellings.
The Canadian spellings. I think maybe one of your biggest pieces of evidence there.
You know what I think is one of the biggest too is the horrible code. I mean, people always want to say, yeah, Satoshi had to be a super duper cryptographer. But like, everybody who looked at the original code is like, shit, it's horrible. And when I brought that up to Peter, he got very defensive. So there's a lot of stuff that obviously couldn't make the cut. It's in my head where I'm like, okay, there's just so much more there. But I mean, that just that takes so many people off the list in the beginning. Almost all of the usual suspects immediately taken off the list. It's Adam Back, it's Nick Sabov, it's Wei Dai, Len Sassman. All these guys are super coders. They do great stuff. It wouldn't have looked that way. It wouldn't have, the code just wouldn't have looked horrible. So, you know, unless some people believe, you know, it's all misdirection. But Occam's Razor here. I mean, when you play the Occam's Razor game, if you were to just type into Spokio right now, who owns the Satoshi email account, guess whose name has come up for any number of years? Peter Todd. And it's one of those things where everyone's like, maybe it was a data scraping error. It couldn't be just hiding in plain sight like that, right? You know, it's just one more weird coincidence, I suppose.
Yeah. One thing I like about this movie is that it you make your case based on like basically abductive reasoning, which is like, you know, an inference to the best explanation. And what's nice about this is that it allows you to like kind of converge upon a particular hypothesis based upon, you know, the information you have. But at the same time, it doesn't really rest upon any particular piece of evidence. And what's kind of frustrating about this is that like most of these other pieces of evidence, you could always explain in some alternative way. Like you mentioned, maybe there's some sort of data scraping error that connects that Peter Todd to that email address. Maybe Peter Todd just genuinely wanted to like offer a sort of a well, actually explanation to or correction to Satoshi in that forum post. Maybe whoever coded, Bitcoin in his early days was just sloppy at first and thought it'd be an iterative process and would improve upon it later. But, you know, all of these other pieces of information, the fact, yeah, it's the Canadian spellings, by the way, not just British spellings, but the fact that it combines sometimes British and American spellings, which I'm going to refer to my Canadian expert here. As my understanding, this is a common practice in Canada. You don't strictly use either one.
Absolutely. There's like a code switching, so to speak, in terms of spelling. You kind of forget which ones you're supposed to be doing because Canadian is closer to British, but then like the main people you interact with are American. So it's like the social influence and then the proper objective influence. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so like every individual piece of evidence you might be able to explain in some other way, but like all together, I mean, it just makes an interesting case that this, you know, like I said, $1.3 trillion asset was created by a 23-year-old fine arts student. It's crazy to think about.
Well, it was fascinating. I mean, I had a sense this would be the case, but I didn't think it would happen so rapidly. You know, there was a leak that came out maybe 10 hours before the film was released on HBO. And the leak showed it was this kind of blurry, hard to see version of the conclusion. It had subtitles and whatnot, you know, and the community just tried to write this off, this conclusion off, before the film even came out. Like, oh, no way it could be him. And they circled wagons. And it was a fascinating thing to behold because, including Peter Todd, nobody has said, A, he couldn't have been behind it and written the code. Doesn't make any sense. Sometimes they'll point to his age and then they realize, oh, he was 23 at the time. They think he was younger. And so to me, it was just fascinating to watch the speed with which they said, kind of, lol, no, couldn't be him, without engaging with the evidence, without really even wanting to engage with the evidence. I mean, I guess it's no big surprise, you know, the DYOR, do your own research. This is a slogan they throw around aplenty. There was some crossover with the QAnons on the DYOR. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, they just looked to some other influencer, some Bitcoin influencer, is like, yeah, I watched it for you, so you don't have to. Anyway, nothing there. Let's move it on. Keep the Bitcoin price strong. And it worked. Bitcoin price didn't really take a hit. In fact, it's been going up.
It's going up.
It's on the bull run right now. Yeah.
Did anybody reach out to you, like from that community or people who were involved after watching the movie and go, hey, I think you're actually onto something, and provide like any additional evidence or anything? Or was it kind of a resounding LULZ, which is the international, we don't want to engage with this, but we want other people who read our content to think it's a joke?
So I have had a number of people who were there in the early days reach out, give me the nod, you know. They don't want to be dragged into this fight, and they don't want to be known as kind of nodding to that. There were others who interacted with him early on who messaged me and were like, there's no way it could be him. And then we would go back and forth, and I would say, well, why couldn't it be him? And they'd say, well, you know, it's partially his personality. In the beginning, he really downplayed his ability to code. It didn't seem like he was a great coder. And you're like, well, yeah, but how do you know that wasn't more game theory? How do you know when he reemerged on the scene that he wasn't just trying to downplay his abilities? And I think the case that we make in the film, where we point out this whole LARP he puts together to write some code for once for Bitcoin, which is the code that is the thing Satoshi was speculating on that he corrects Satoshi on before disappearing, it's very clear his abilities. And he has to construct his motive, I guess, for constructing this whole LARP. And then pretending there's a hack and then this thing gets released is to show this community, okay, the only reason he did some code is because of this narrative that he invented. And so when you start parsing this down and you talk with people who knew him at that time, they quickly reevaluate and go, oh my gosh, like that moment in the film where you challenge him on C++ and you say, could you code in C++? And he gaslights me, lies, pretends he can't. And then I say, actually, you know, went on the Wayback Machine, found your old resume. You can. Mm-hmm. This is the same kind of techniques that I think he was using in the early days. And so the more I talk with people who knew him at that time, they start to realize that maybe they'd been gaslit too.
Mm. I mean, it's kind of hard to sort of like pin down Peter Todd's like motivations or what he really believes. Because he's described as a contrarian of contrarians in the film and kind of a troll, someone who sometimes says things not because he necessarily believes them, but to get a reaction. Also, this is kind of why I had some sort of wariness about the evidence related to his strange reaction when you confronted with this evidence, just because, you know, again, this might be by design. It's very difficult to know, you know, I guess, the sincere beliefs of Peter Todd.
Mm-hmm. If you were to come back, say you had been Satoshi and you reemerge on the scene, and you want to muddy the waters, make it so people don't think you're actually Satoshi, but simultaneously position yourself to be a leader in that space, be able to go up against the guy who you presumably handed Bitcoin off to, which in this story is Gavin Andreessen, Peter rises to that position almost immediately, helming Dark Wallet. What would be your strategy to convince people that, yeah, believe me, but at the same time, no way you could be Satoshi? You would have to do any number of things to kind of muddy the waters. And I think over time, those techniques would evolve and improve. But right from the beginning, you would have to, there's any number of things you might do, like downplay your coding abilities. So I think Peter Todd is a master of game theory. I think he's a fucking genius. And I think that a lot of that game theory is what's playing out online right now. That lol, no response is exactly what he intended. And he even says that in the confrontation scene. That'll be the response. And I think that's his strategy. And I also suspect that over time, more and more people in that community will actually watch the film and look at the evidence. There's more evidence that's coming out now. That's supplementary. And maybe over time, they will come around to the reality that it really makes a lot more sense than the usual list of suspects. Also, though, the troll thing you're saying, though, think about what Ron does.
Right.
You know, there's a technique that both of these guys use where you throw so much shit at the wall that nothing sticks. You go, okay, how am I supposed to know what's real or what to believe when you say all these contradictory things? It's a very effective technique.
It's like when I play poker, which is not often, but in my, you know, high school and college years, people really got into Texas Hold'em. It was like a big thing and people would play all the time. And I'm the kind of guy who wears my heart on my sleeve. It's if I'm feeling a certain type of way, you will know it. I can't really hide my emotions at all. But I would be really good at poker because what I would do is, because I know that, I act absolutely fucking crazy. And you can never know, like, what, you know, I'll have a bad hand and be acting like my hand is shit, or I'll have a good hand and be acting like my hand is shit, or I'll have a bad hand and be acting like it's good. Because if I'm making the decision to just, like what you said, like throw so much shit against the wall that it's impossible to know what to believe, it actually was like a fairly effective strategy for me. And so I don't know, at least on a personal level, I can sort of understand like where you're coming from, especially if you're a guy like, you know, whoever Satoshi is, who is sitting on this insane amount of wealth and power, which leads me to the question I was going to ask earlier, Colin, is like, if you have indeed, or, you know, are recognized as exposing people who do not want to be exposed, who have an insane amount of wealth. And I'm not talking just about Satoshi. I'm talking about all of the people in this circle who were in Bitcoin very early, who no doubt are multi-millionaires, if not billionaires. Are you at all concerned that that kind of wealth might be detrimental to your safety?
Like staying alive?
Yeah.
I mean, yes and no. I think that they would be more adept at just trying to run like a smear campaign to try to discredit. I mean, it's not inconceivable, but it's also not, it's just not a thing I prioritize when I'm working on this stuff. Is like, okay, well, yeah. I guess I shouldn't look because, you know, maybe somebody who's worth X number of dollars might spend some of that money to take me out. Here's a crazy thing. So like just in the weeks before the film premieres, there are 250 Bitcoin that moved from January 2009 wallets. These are wallets that were within weeks of Bitcoin's creation.
Oh, wow.
That's $16 million. Then some of that, or those early wallets move on to Kraken, move on to an exchange. There is, to your point, there is, I really think there's no way that we could have kept what was coming a secret. There were plenty of people in the media that we'd had to reach out to about the film. I think it's highly likely, given how early those wallets are, that it was Satoshi. Now, what people will say is, but it didn't follow the what's called the Patoshi pattern. This is the Satoshi mining pattern that allowed researchers in 2013 to figure out, okay, these are the coins that Satoshi likely mined. It was a bug that allowed that to be revealed. A bug that Peter, in fact, called the researcher a shitty person for having uncovered. Anyway, so if you're Satoshi and you want to pull some early coins out, you know which coins follow that pattern. You're not going to touch those coins. It's entirely possible that in the beginning, like, think about how many old shit computers you have sitting around. You just have some other computer that doesn't follow the pattern, that maybe grabs a couple coins here and there. Those would be the coins you would touch. So to me, it doesn't mean that it's not Satoshi who moved those coins. It just means that it didn't follow the pattern. And considering those coins moved within weeks of air, and there hasn't been a movement that early in over a decade, is telling.
Yeah.
Well, and also, didn't Peter Todd say on Twitter or whatever that he was like, I had interviewed with Colin a bunch of times, and it was only at that last interview did I realize, like, kind of what he was getting at, and that he was sort of making the accusation that it was me.
Well, maybe the accusation part. I mean, he was going on X trying to find a grip around any kind of argument that he could. So one of them was, oh, I didn't know it was going to be a film related to Satoshi. If I had known, I wouldn't have been involved. I mean, that first scene in the cave a year earlier, we're talking about Satoshi. We're talking about clues related to Satoshi, whether or not he's Satoshi. So it's
right,
just...
that's true, yeah.
It's not an intellectually honest argument that he's making. And there were no shortage of those that he made on X. It would be like looking at the correction post and trying to find some little detail to try to make people miss the forest for the trees. It was a pretty effective strategy, but no, anybody who asked us, we would send out the summary that said exactly what the film ended up being, which was confirmed by other participants. So it's just Peter grasping at straws, really.
You know, something that was interesting in the film is that you talk a little bit about the sort of the early sort of ideological battles regarding the development and use of Bitcoin, which was, you know, fascinating on its own. And you talk about the ways in which Amir Taaki and Satoshi had kind of a falling out over WikiLeaks accepting Bitcoin. And Taaki, he wanted more of a sort of a open source collaboration regarding the project, and whereas Satoshi preferred a more like closed development model. I mean, am I summarizing that accurately?
So Amir Taaki, he's this crypto anarchist guy who gets involved with Bitcoin as a developer around the time that Satoshi stops posting on the forums. So this is around the time that Satoshi, who trusted Gavin Andreessen to kind of take over the project as a, you know, a real person, as opposed to Satoshi as this pseudonymous character. So this ideological battle that forms between someone like Amir, who is interested in undermining the state, is really between Amir and Gavin.
Oh, okay.
Not Amir and Satoshi.
Okay.
And in fact, it wouldn't be long before Satoshi gets pissed off at Gavin and completely cuts ties. And that happens when Gavin says he's going to go visit the CIA, at which point Satoshi's like, all right, we're done here, and cuts ties with Gavin. So, and this is what I think the Peter Todd theory does more than any other theory I've ever seen. It shows motive. And if you look at what happens there, if imagine Satoshi, you handed off this thing to Gavin, now he's taken it to the CIA. You see the way that he's steering the project. He's not necessarily rewarding the devs. He's not steering it the way he wanted. How do you then come back and wrestle control from Gavin? What do you do? Would you be pretty annoyed with Gavin? Would you put yourself in opposition to Gavin? That's exactly what Peter Todd does. And boy, he talked a lot of shit about Gavin. So, you know, if you came back in and even when I would ask Peter, okay, like, what did you, you know, what did you think about that handoff where Satoshi makes kind of puts Gavin in charge of the project? And Peter's response is, well, that doesn't mean you're the leader. If you want to just be a spokesperson, fine, at least do a good job of it. So he has these kind of insights into the mind of Satoshi that no one else had. And he also, his behavior pattern in relationship to someone like Gavin, I think also underscores motive.
There's another interesting point here. There's a section of the film that talks about these emails that go back and forth between Peter Todd and a supposed CIA agent or some sort of three-letter agent named John Dillon. And, you know, it seems like the film's sort of hypothesis and other people within the community is that Peter Todd is sort of authored these emails himself. He created this agent that he was talking to in order to enact the patch that allowed the fees something. I really don't understand like Bitcoin or
it's,
anything.
It's complicated. Like, that's part of why it's hard to unpack.
Yeah, it's so complicated. It's like I never grew up with Nintendo.
I'm so sorry.
We had Sega Genesis, which was cool, and Commodore, which was great. But like when it comes to solving Nintendo puzzles, like I tried to play the latest Zeldas, the latest Link games, at
Tears
least.
Tears of the Kingdom?
Yeah, Tears of the Kingdom, all that stuff. And when it comes to solving those puzzles, I just can't wrap my brain around it because I don't think like Nintendo. And I feel like very similar with blockchain, Bitcoin, and all of this stuff.
Wait, so Jake, are you saying that the reason I do these stories is because I'm a big Zelda enthusiast. And
I'm making a horrible analogy, which is what I do on this show. I make bad analogies that bring that put the focus on me. But really, what I'm all to say that you know, if you cut out if you're Satoshi, right, and you cut out Gavin because he's going to the CIA to talk Bitcoin, and you have a deep hatred for you know, these three letter agencies or this, you know, the state in general, which I think is evidenced very early on in Peter Todd's sort of ideology. You know, when he's asking about Hashcoin and all this stuff. See, your doc was so good, I'm retaining some of this stuff, which is amazing.
I'm really impressed.
What better way to throw people off the trail to think you're Satoshi than you're working with some kind of agency, right? Like, oh, well, Peter Todd was talking with this agent guy. We know Satoshi fucking hates the three-letter agencies because look at what he did to Gavin after he said he was going to go to the CIA. I think that, I don't know, to me, that's another kind of built-in sort of like little piece of wanting to throw somebody off the trail to be like, oh, this guy was working with somebody who claimed to be from an agency. Well, we know that Satoshi hated the idea that the agencies could get it fundamentally disagreed with the ideology behind Bitcoin, so could never ever be this guy if he's willing to work with these dudes.
I think that's a good read. I think, yeah. Imagine if you're writing this email chain between yourself and yourself, and you're trying to, like you say, sort of dissuade people from ever thinking it's you. You're planning to leak this at some point in the future. Yeah, you might bake in some elements that seem very anti-Satoshi-like. So I think that's a pretty sound read. You know, and everything speaks to this motive of like, why create this character? Why go through so much effort to send these emails back and forth and then invent a hack and dump these emails all so you could write some code? It just doesn't make any sense. It's too much work. There has to be a deeper motive.
Mm. Yeah, no, what's really fascinating about this is that, you know, if your hypothesis is correct, you haven't just uncovered, like, who Satoshi. You've also uncovered the story of, like, this world historical genius who managed to create this, you know, this vast, impactful technology, and then during its development did multiple things to cover up his involvement from like the most technical minded people in the world in every single, you know, newsroom, investigative newsroom in the world, and did that in his early 20s. Which, you know, and then, I don't know, I think it would be hard, it'd be hard for someone, like, with any kind of, like, you know, ego to accomplish so much and then be, I don't know, be so comfortable with hiding your responsibility for your accomplishments, you know?
Maybe. I mean, if you had a whole group of people who were invested in protecting that secret, if you told them you were never going to access the stash,
okay.
If you enjoyed being, you know, the smartest guy in the room, if you enjoyed pulling, you know, the wool over all these journalists, no one being able to figure it out. Yeah, I think there's plenty of incentives to keep that a secret, especially now, considering how much Bitcoin is worth. And people will say, oh, well, you know, why wouldn't Satoshi tap their stash? I think I would make the argument that, well, first off, Satoshi probably kept mining after the bug was fixed, assuming they're alive, right? So they would have plenty of Bitcoin. And I think that there is Bitcoin that didn't necessarily fall in line with the Satoshi pattern. So do you really need more than like 50 million bucks to get by? I mean, you could get by on that, live a perfectly comfortable life. And then there's this sort of like the one ring, sort of the Tolkien one ring that's just sitting there tempting you. And there's a reason they gave it to the Hobbit, not to a human. And I asked Peter about, you know, what he thinks might have happened to the stash. And again, he kind of peers into the mind of Satoshi and he says, well, if I was Satoshi, I would have destroyed my ability to access it. That way you'd never be tempted. And then he went on to say, you know, of course, if as time passes and Bitcoin's value goes up, it'd be a lot harder to let that go. And we find that message with him in those chat logs from the Bitcoin Wizards IRC, where he seems to be saying that he destroyed the Bitcoin in some sort of, you know, he made the largest sacrifice and he destroyed it by hand. He might contest what he meant with that, but he hasn't explained how he destroyed it physically by hand or really what he meant. So to me, that reads like he was trying to convince his inner circle back in the day that yes, in fact, he had destroyed his access. And that would be a good reason to help protect the secret. And also because he wants to protect the secret. I mean, he was the only person through this entire investigation who ever actively dissuaded me from pursuing it. After we did that first shoot together, and I was messaging him, just asking for some technical details. I just wanted to understand how that error had worked that allowed Satoshi's stash to be revealed. You know, and he responded, and that's when he called the researcher who did that a shitty person for doing so. And then he told me, Satoshi doesn't want to be found, leave them alone. And kind of reinforcing that. So again, also the idea that Peter didn't know what story I was after here is just dishonest.
My take, Jake's take on this is that nobody would destroy, if they knew that they were sitting on like $1 trillion, right? And it was a secret. It goes back to this thing that like, that's the fun. That's part of the fun. These people, you know, myself included in some way, like the internet is a place where people who don't have the best time, like IRL, can be kings and queens, you know? There's power in your identity on the internet, you know, in the internet in ways that you maybe don't fit into society, like these groups of hackers, cypherpunks, all of this. There's an element and kind of a pride, right, on not sort of fitting in with the norm and not being part of the regular society. And that's kind of what Bitcoin is all about. And so the idea that an outcast is actually the richest person in the world and it's your little secret, and every time you go out and you buy a candy bar or a coffee or you go on a date or have lunch with somebody and you know that you're sitting on like $1 trillion and nobody knows, personally, I have a very hard time believing that somebody would throw that away, because it is one hell of an insurance policy. And if you are worried about the government cracking down on you or getting, if you're worried about ramifications or consequences based on things you did when you were like a genius 23-year-old, sitting on $1 trillion is like one hell of an insurance policy. So I don't know. And maybe I'm speaking from like screenwriter movie brain, but I'm like, no way you throw something like that away. You tell people you do, you know, or you insinuate that whoever it is must have done that. But I don't know. I don't know. I think it is still sitting there tempting whoever it is, if they're still, you know, if they're still around and if they still have access.
Yeah. I mean, would you keep a copy? Because that's right. All it is. They're just passwords, right? I mean, if you could say you destroyed the computer that had all the wallets on it, but yeah, would you keep a copy?
Just in fucking case. Just in case. Because you never know. You never know what life is going to throw at you. And like, to know in the back of your mind, can you imagine how many people, how they would live their lives if they knew in the back of their mind that they could type in, you know, cool guy 43 into a password field, and all of a sudden access like $1 trillion or $100 billion, like It's too good. We're too greedy. It's too, I don't know. It's the fee that you pay yourself for coming up with this thing, right? Like, that's how you justify it. You're like, well, I mean, I've changed the world. Like, I integrated this new currency. Like, this is my retirement. Like, how could it not be? I don't know. And maybe 50 million is enough. And I'm thinking too big, or I just don't.
Well, Jake, it's enough to get by on, right? Yeah. Like, until, you know, while you wait for, I don't know, a bunch of countries to bake it into their treasuries, you know, get it in the stock market. Once it's integrated enough, you could come out at that point. And then what's going to happen? It's already integrated. It sets us up for like a Ready Player One kind of plot. Or some Willy Wonka shit. We're just like, okay, we're going to set everybody on a quest. You want to become the richest person in the world? You want to control 1/20th the supply of all the digital gold?
If movies have taught us everything, and they have. No, but like, one thing I wanted to ask you about is I was really fascinated by the whole like El Salvador sort of like plot line about, I didn't know that El Salvador had this like young crypto bro as like their president. I was like, that's so odd. Like, he's on stage and like all white and like a backwards hat being like, Bitcoin is the future. I'm like, this feels like some sort of like crypto conference, but this guy's like the president of El Salvador. And then you were interviewing like one of the senators, and he was like another young cool guy. I was like, this is crazy. Like, over here, like, they have all these like young quote unquote cool seeming people in government. You look at us, it's just like a bunch of Q-tips. Like, it's so interesting to like see that contrast. And I don't know if it's a good thing or not what they're doing, but I found that like very interesting.
I mean, he's very well liked down there. He's very well liked in El Salvador. I think when people saw the film, we had to put right up front that this was in fact the president, because they did not believe that guy on stage was El Salvador's president. So you are not alone in that assumption.
Can you imagine if we had like a young, I don't know, like 32-year-old guy who was like the president of the United States, and he was like, yeah, he was like, new Call of Duty coming out, but like no microtransaction. I don't know. Like, it just, that feels like a world that's so impossible to have in the United States.
Yeah, the president banning painkiller in Modern Warfare 2 or something.
I don't know, man. Maybe after this next election cycle, we'll all just be voting on X, right? And it'll just be, and your vote will be who has the most followers, and they just become the next president. Then you might get your fantasy, Jake. Then then we get a 32-year-old who's in Call of Duty.
Yeah, it could be a fantasy, but it could also be a nightmare. I see both equally at the same time. Both timelines look grim.
A dystopian fantasy.
Sure. Yeah. Fair. We'll leave it at that.
One of the things I was interested in relation to like the parallel we were talking before about Q Into the Storm and then this talk is like, did Q Into the Storm in any way, like, do you think provide a liability in terms of getting to some of these people? Because it's like, oh yeah, here's the doc I made where I was following these people, and then I revealed some secret in relation to their online like presence. Like, especially in relation to like Todd. Like, I wonder why he would sign up to do so, like, because as you say, like, he knew that it was about Satoshi. Like, do you think that's like another thing of like him, oh, I'm going to trick this other journalist as well? Like, he has no clue.
You'd be surprised how rarely people look you up
right
before agreeing to do an interview. I don't think that Peter Todd bothered to do a search on the work I'd done until like the last shoot. There was some point where he came up to me like, oh, you're that guy again. Yeah, yeah. Now, I made that terms and conditions. He's like, well, anyone can say they made a film about digital privacy. Like, but no, like, I did actually make that. And then I asked him, like, did you ever see Q Into the Storm? Do you know what happens in that series? And no, he hadn't seen it, and he hadn't looked it up. So I think that there is just a general blanket assumption that like anyone with a camera, journalists in general, just kind of dismisses them, doesn't hold them in very high regard. You know, Adam was a little different. Adam Back, I think he did maybe a little bit more research, but no, Peter, I don't think Peter knew that my filmography.
Meanwhile, Ron Watkins is like in his bedroom somewhere being like, oh, phew, like Colin has moved on to somebody, to exposing the identity of some other anonymous internet poster. Like, all right, not me anymore. Okay. You still talk to Ron?
I get messages from him occasionally. I got a message from him being like, hey, man, help me out with this prediction market. Because as you may have seen, there was a $40 million prediction market that revved up around the conclusion of this film on Polymarket.
Yeah,
$40 million were at stake. I think a lot of people were pretty pissed off that the horse that they picked for Satoshi didn't end up being who we pointed to in the film. So I think that could have also fueled some of the frustration afterwards. But yeah, Ron's just like, yeah, could you do me a solid and just tell me the answer?
Hold on,
please?
Colin. Wait a minute. Let me hold on. I'm opening the front of my brain. Let me try to wrap my head around this. Ron Watkins, the guy who you basically accused of authoring the majority of the QAnon posts 3 or so years ago, hit you up because he knew that you were working on this new movie and he wanted you to give him insider information so he could make money on Polymarket, which, as I understand, is like a crypto betting site.
Yeah.
Welcome to the reality, huh?
Oh my God, dude. He's like, it was so most interesting when Cullen sort of figured me as Q, but like, I could probably make a couple $1 million if I actually did know who he ends up fingering in his new documentary.
Is the implication like you owe me one? Like, you know, you exposed me. Like, help me out here.
Help me out. Yeah, exactly. Do me a solid, bro. Like, you made my life very sticky for like a couple of months after your doc. Like, hey, come on. Like, let a brother stack some more crypto.
I mean, quite literally. He's like, well, I had to ask.
How did our lives get so weird and so stupid, kind of, but also kind of so interesting?
It's funny how all these worlds. I mean, you just have to laugh at a certain point how all this stuff plays out. It never plays out the way that you think that it will. You know, maybe in 4 years, Peter Todd will be in my inbox asking for like tips on like a Polymarket bet. But he'll be like, yeah, I'm just going to be putting like a few mil behind that. You know, I don't know where I got it from, but I could just use the pocket change. Help me out, Colin. Could happen. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't have expected after making Q into the storm that I would ever hear from Ron again. Right.
Right. So, yeah.
But, you know, I get occasional messages here and there.
Well, listen, I want to say that, you know, if you are thinking about what other anonymous entity to expose next, I'm going to offer a few suggestions. There's classic, of course. The first one that comes to mind is John Titor, the alleged time traveler who posted. I think that would be a really good one.
Oh, Travis, you're speaking my language. Yeah. I didn't even think of that, but that would be so fun.
That'd be fun. Another classical one, the Count of Saint Germain, the 18th century, possibly just a weird scammer who appeared on the scene in high society and then disappeared. They got to be a worthwhile one. And also, I don't think anyone's, maybe people have already done this one, but the Stig from the British car show, Top Gear. So anyways, just spitballing.
D.B. Cooper.
Hollywood Travis doing pitches. Come on, this is my gig, man. Like, I'm supposed to like sidebar with Cullen and be like, hey, man, yeah, I got a couple people I'd really like you to track down.
Well, I mean, I have been chipping away at a potential follow-up to Q, which I think you may know about. And then I'm also interested in the Cicada 3301 of it all and trying to unpack that little mystery. And, you know, St. Germain, the thing you just mentioned, Travis, does intersect with the cicada story.
Hmm.
Here's what I'll say, though. I think AI is going to put me out of a job, not because it can do my job, but because it's going to ruin people's ability to be these kind of like anonymous characters online. How can you do forensics if you just have AI generating all of these anonymous characters? You really can't anymore. So I think we've hit our limit for anonymous characters and being able to track them down.
It would be nice if we could get a definitive of who wrote the drops. It's every now and again, I like sit back and I go, I can't believe that we don't like know 100%, or that nobody has come out and been like, yup, it was me. Here's the forensic evidence. Here's what I was trying to do. Here's how it got away from me. Yada, yada, yada. It just feels like, ugh, I've spent so we all have. Colin, I remember.
Well, Jake, this is why I was quietly chipping away at a potential follow-up, because I really wanted to nail that down. I can't tell you on this episode what we might have uncovered, but assuming that gets made, I think more will come out. I think some of your questions will be answered.
Thank God. I mean, look at my life. Look at my life. I'm here. I'm sitting in front of the Zoom. I've got Travis. I've got Liv. I've got you, who was interviewing us, God, like years ago, before HBO, before anything. Just a guy also interested in this shit. And like, so much of my life is different now because of QAnon. And to not really know, like, I'm, you know, there's a lot of people that are like, it doesn't really matter, like, actually. And in some ways, politically, it doesn't. The damage is already done. But as somebody who studies this and whose entire life changed because of studying this and being interested in it, it's like, it plagues me. Like, I really want to know. I'm curious. Travis, Liv, I mean, do you feel the same way? Is it something that you are also kind of still hoping to at least know who was responsible?
Of course, there are a dozen of very frustrating loose threads in that mystery. Things like, you know, the extent of, for example, I don't know, praying medic David Hayes's involvement in the Q drops, because it's pretty clear he, at the very least to me, it suggests that he was communicating with people who are doing that. But yeah, there's lots of loose threads and unsolved mysteries regarding who was behind the Q drops that I certainly would love to see solved one of these days.
I've always thought it was like, I've always really wanted to know what our intelligence agencies thought about it at the time. Was there internal, you know, there had to have been internal comms. And with the amount of surveillance technology, I find it hard to believe that any of the three-letter agencies did not know definitively who was posting, especially once it became this thing that leapt off the internet and into the real world. And why did the agencies not dox that person? Why did they? I don't know. There's so many questions that I would love to know. So Colin, you better answer all of them. And if not, I will be talking to some very high level Bitcoin developers and encouraging them to use, you know, one coin. I mean, if they've got, you know, a couple hundred, one coin is all it would really take, you know?
Well, here's a funny, I mean, I share this. This is why I, even after doing the series, these lingering questions, I also want resolution. I couldn't put it on the shelf. But there is another striking analogy, I think, between Bitcoin and the Q-verse. You know, this whole where we go one, we go all thing. Or the, it doesn't matter who Q is. There's a very simple, similar line of logic in the Bitcoin space. Mm. They will say, we are all Satoshi. It sounds a hell of a lot like where we go one, we go all. Yeah. And there's also this idea, it doesn't matter who Satoshi is. You know, it's fascinating to me that there's these two mantras that are very similar, and that there's also a belief within each group that it doesn't matter who the anonymous figure is. But of course, everybody kind of wants to know at the same time. And I've wondered, does that emanate from a kind of epicenter where there's kind of a core group that first says like, okay, we've all kind of entered into a suicide pact, you know, where we go one, we go all, or whatever. And then it just kind of feeds out to the broader group. You know, did that happen with Satoshi at some point where maybe, you know, if we play this theory out, Peter Todd let a few more people in on the secret. And at some point they go, we are all Satoshi, which would enable Peter to go online and say, I am not Satoshi because we are all Satoshi. But then that idea kind of spreads out and just becomes this thought terminating cliche that gets repeated by, you know, the community. I found it fascinating, the level, the amount of similarities, not just in the anonymous character themselves, but also in how the community thinks about that anonymous character.
The documentary is called Money Electric, The Bitcoin Mystery. Check it out on Max. It is really, really interesting, regardless of whether or not you agree with the conclusion. But the case is fascinating. The history of crypto laid out is really, really well done. So yeah, check it out, Theo. So thanks for coming on, Colin.
Hope to see you all again in 3 years.
Yeah.
Oh, please, no. Don't make it that long, dude. Call us like 6 months from now and be like, I have the answers. It's coming
out. I wish I could get a film done. done that quickly. I wish I had the wish I could get it done in 6 months. I always lie to myself. Say I can get it done that fast. It takes 3 years. I'm sorry.
All right. We'll see you in 3 years, I guess. Hopefully not before then, because if we do before then and we're hearing about Cullen when there isn't a new project, it's gonna be bad news, I feel like.
Oh boy. Let's hope it's another project then. At least you'll have some sense of where to look. Yeah. There's a fairly short list of suspects. Always fun to end on a note of hope you don't die.
Yeah, well, we'll find out.
Thanks for listening to another premium episode of the QAA Podcast. We've got a website. It's qaapodcast.com.
Listener, until next week, may the deepest of dishes bless you and keep you. Amen.
Amen.
We have auto-queued content based on your preferences.
Here's what I think happened. Possibly.
Possibly.
Okay. I think that John Dillon was created so that you would have an excuse to make Replaced by Fee, a concept which you had envisioned years earlier, but you needed some kind of cover in order to make. And you also needed some cover for that 2010 post.
2010 post, please. Yeah, because I was Satoshi.
I mean, yeah. You know, you're very concerned about all the privacy stuff. So you reach out to your old buddy Adam Back. You say, we need to do something about this, but we need to pay the devs. But you can't join Blockstream because it would look too suspicious. So you don't.
I will admit, you're pretty creative. You come up with some crazy theories. It's ludicrous. But it's the sort of theory someone who spends their time as a documentary journalist would come up with. So yeah. I'll say, of course I'm Satoshi, and I'm Craig Wright. And yes, I was definitely covering that little bit about, you know, Fee is to go pretend to be Satoshi, or not Satoshi, one or the other.